All right, what's going on, guys? So today, really excited because today we're going to be chatting with Alan Aragon. We're going to be talking all about ketogenic diets and performance specifically for powerlifting. So Alan is somewhat of an expert. He's got some really great stuff that he's kind of been doing, that he's currently doing. And yeah, he goes like this, but he's done a lot of really crazy stuff. I guess I'll kind of let you introduce yourself, let the listeners know a little bit about yourself, some of the work that you've done, and just take it away.
First of all, Daniel, thank you so much for inviting me on the podcast. It's always an honor when somebody of your stature in the industry thinks that my information is worth listening to. And you mentioned that you've been subscribed to my research review, which is very flattering, and you benefit from that. So thank you for that. I am an educator more than anything. So my practitioner work spanned the first couple decades of my career, and then the previous 10 years or so have been mostly research and education. I'm probably best known as one of the forefathers of the evidence-based movement in the fitness industry, where when I say we, I mean some of the forerunners like Lyle McDonald, Will Brink, and myself. We tried to push for a higher degree of discrimination and rigor as far as the scientific basis for recommendations in the fitness sphere. Like, we wanted to go a bit further beyond just asking the biggest dude in the gym or asking the best looking person in the room, okay, what should I eat for this goal, or how should I train for that goal? We recognized that there was a lot of value in objective data. And so we can use a research basis as a platform from which to individualize programs rather than just simply going by hearsay and gym gossip. So that's the general picture of what I'm about and who I am. My colleagues and I, we've done a lot of the, what I would like to think is some of the seminal research in nutrient timing and the anabolic response to nutrient timing, not just the anabolic response in the short term, but over the longer term, how nutrient timing affects adaptations to resistance training. So we did a lot of the re-examining of the anabolic window work and the other stuff, like just general protein timing, fasted versus fed cardio, various research pieces like that, protein distribution through the day. And so that's kind of my research concentration, and that's my influence on the field.
Getting right into kind of the subject matter. So we're going to be talking about ketogenic diets. Because that seems to be really, really popular. Now, it's definitely not new. I think it was around like back in the 50s or something like that. And then it kind of made a really strong resurgence recently, which I think a lot of diets do kind of have this cyclical approach, right? The low carb, the ketogenic diets, the vegans, all this different stuff where, you know, people forget about it. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's a new way of marketing it. And so right now it's super, super popular. A lot of people are kind of claiming that it does this, it doesn't do that. And so I just kind of wanted to clear the air and get a much better understanding of what it actually does, who it's for, and some of the practical limitations as it pertains to powerlifting. So can you kind of give us an overview of the ketogenic diet? And then I guess also to be a little bit nitpicky, the ketogenic diet, the differences between the actual, like what's classified as ketogenic diet and what people are actually implementing in more real world scenarios?
Okay, so the definition of a ketogenic diet, it varies, but the way that we can narrow it down is that you can impose ketosis by consuming roughly 50 grams of carbohydrate per day or less. In some instances where people have a high enough training volume, and or a caloric deficit is still presented, people can still be in ketosis even at up to 100 grams of carbohydrate a day. But generally speaking, to achieve ketosis and maintain it, you would need 50 grams of carbohydrate tops per day. And that's how you maintain a ketogenic diet. So there are other ways that people can impose ketosis by exogenous means or by ketone supplements, and regardless of what their base diet is, but that's a whole other thing. So that's basically what ketosis is.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that often comes up is talking about protein distribution within mm-hmm. that diet. And so, you know, when you have proteins kind of being converted through into the actual like glycogen, mm-hmm. then that tends to offset it sometimes. So that's kind of one of the criticisms where some people are saying like, okay, well, you're not necessarily following the actual like clinical or more clinical definitions of ketogenic diet. You're focusing on like a high protein, high fat, low carbohydrate diet. Does that really matter at all?
There is kind of a long-standing misconception that if you go on a high protein diet, you're going to force gluconeogenesis to up ramp, and then you're going to kick yourself out of ketosis. Mm-hmm. So that is simply not true, because there have been several studies that have administered protein above 2 grams per kilogram body weight. There's even one, I believe it was Burke and colleagues, where the subjects were consuming 2.7 grams per kilogram of body weight and still maintaining ketosis throughout the length of the study. So some of the, one of the more common cutoffs that people throw around as far as an upper limit of protein intake that will still allow ketogenesis is 1.5 grams per kilo of body weight. And they recommend not going above that. I believe it could have been Volek and or Finney who mentioned that, but that just hasn't stood up to the bulk of the studies that have showed 2 grams per kilo and up, still showing subjects in ketosis. So as far as I've seen, 2.7 will still keep you in ketosis as an athlete.
That's crazy. I saw the research going up to 2. I didn't know they had anything looking at like as high as 2.7. That is quite high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. And so like when we're looking at ketogenic diets, what kind of benefits does it have to strength training or performance, if any?
Okay. Well, with ketogenic diets, it's more a matter of that they do not cause major detriment to strength training sports. Mm-hmm. Like your body can basically put up with it or survive it. That's not necessarily the case with sports further along the continuum towards the endurance side of the continuum. So interestingly, powerlifting and sports that involve maximal strength output, those sports, interestingly, are not consistently negatively affected by ketogenic diets. Mm-hmm. And there are several studies now showing this. So before this latest slew of studies that cropped up really within the last 5 years or so, prior to that, the assumption was made that we need to go just the classical athletic high carb, low fat diet in order to maximize every type of athletic performance across the strength endurance continuum. But lo and behold, there have been several comparisons now of the high carb, low fat with bona fide ketogenic diets on maximal strength performance. And interestingly, we can't rightly say that you're going to screw yourself over maximal strength wise by going on a ketogenic diet. And if you think about that mechanistically, then it's plausible, because with maximal strength, there's more of a neurological facilitation required to affect max strength outputs in like, let's say 1 to 3 RM max range. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're bodybuilding it out at somewhere between like 6 to 20 reps, the performance of that is much more demanding of glycogen stores than it is kind of this neurological feat that you have to pull off in order to get up a one rep max. So yeah, that's the story behind ketogenic diets and powerlifting versus bodybuilding versus endurance. Your body seems to be much more tolerant and able to withstand and even keep up with the other types of diets if you're powerlifting and if you're doing a ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm. So kind of coming back to that point that you were talking mm-hmm. about of, you know, higher workloads, things that would more so kind of push work capacity. So let's say you have like a high volume block or something like that, where you're really trying to both increase work capacity, increase muscle mass to kind of potentiate strength gains down the road. How would that sort of impact performance within those blocks specifically?
Well, this is where, and that's a really good question because it brings up the issue of the type of subjects that are studied in research versus competitors at the highest levels. So in research, there is an overabundance of studies on untrained subjects. And even when subjects are labeled as trained in research, typically you can call subjects who've been training for 6 months trained. You know, they're no longer untrained. But there's a difference between the research context of trained subjects versus advanced competitive subjects. So when you're looking at high volume blocks and you consider the fact that a typical resistance training bout will deplete anywhere from 20 to 40% of the glycogen reserves of the working muscles, then conceivably, if you're looking at training bouts that can happen more than once a day, or training bouts that affect the same muscle group intensively, even if you're doing different muscle groups, but certain muscle groups can get affected in an overlap fashion, and then you mm-hmm. genuinely can deplete glycogen in high volume scenarios, then in that case, you can build a pretty strong case for the fact that ketogenic dieting would put your performance at risk. And so if you weigh the cost and the benefit, and there's a lot at stake for performance, and you're not just kind of recreationally powerlifting for just bragging rights to your buddies, mm-hmm. I personally wouldn't court the risk of ketogenic dieting on kind of an ongoing par for the course basis.
Mm-hmm. No, and that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, yeah, a lot of the times, I think, you know, evidence-based, right? Like you hear the word a lot, or not yep. the word, the phrase. But sometimes it's a little bit more complex to kind of parse out how those details or the findings would kind of end up or impact, like, I guess, like free living scenarios where, you know, like you were saying, theoretically, yeah, I mean, probably wouldn't affect your strength a whole lot. But then depending on the block, depending on the sensitivity of the individual, depending on, I guess, their level of competitive experience and things like that, that may have an impact, you know, either positively or negatively from one person to another. And then even like, I mean, someone might even just like feel better doing keto. And so maybe they're a little bit more inclined to go in and push a little harder. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to sit here and tell this guy not to do keto if he's doing better and his training's going up, you know? So it's not always kind of as cut and dry. So that's kind of an interesting perspective about the overlap of like glycogen depletion per mm-hmm. muscle specific, I guess. Mm-hmm. So then do you think, this is kind of like, I guess, self-serving question. Do you think that if that were the case, do you think that a lower frequency, I guess, type of program would potentially be better if someone was, you know, doing a ketogenic diet?
Yeah, if somebody was insisting on doing keto, mm-hmm. then their overall daily and weekly volume would be limited. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is on a, like, if they're in a block or a periodization phase where their volume is significantly lower, and you wanted to periodize your intake, your overall energy intake, and thus your carbohydrate intake to kind of match a bit of downtime within the overall training cycle, then it would be warranted. In that way, you can kind of affect kind of this ebb and flow with carbohydrate intake, depending on the fueling required for the work, which is, it takes a little bit more planning and a little bit more thought, but there can be some more efficiency and some more economy of calorie intake going on with that. So it becomes a game of balancing risks to performance with the need to economize on calorie intake.
And so what would the, I guess, the delay be from, let's say there have been some papers that have been written about, you know, using low carbohydrate diets for a while and then just before the race, jacking up your carbohydrate intakes. And there's been kind of like mixed outcomes. My personal opinion is, seems like you're kind of shifting from an efficiency of like carbohydrate, like being able to oxidize carbohydrates really effectively. And so you kind of like blunt that response or that benefit. So does that neutralize out, I guess?
It depends on the sport. Depends on the event that we're talking about. For endurance events, you could well be shooting yourself in the foot by ketoing it in the training. So you're basically, you're training low and then you're competing high, but you've actually trained your body to be better at using fat for fuel and actually being worse at using carbohydrate for fuel, because you kind of change things at the enzymatic level. So a particular enzyme complex, the pyruvate dehydrogenase, the activity of that enzyme, which breaks down glycogen, you essentially train its activity downward as you are getting your body to become more of a, in quotes, a fat burning machine. Mm-hmm. So you become more fat oxidative, but you also become more glycogen impaired. Okay, so depending on the nature of the event, if you're looking at something like strongman or something in the middle, you still could be risking a performance decrease if you go for the training low and competing high model. For powerlifting, it's a little bit more up in the air, and there is actually probably less risk, just based on the research looking at linear keto not necessarily screwing over your powerlifting performance. So that's the messy answer to that.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You did mention earlier about exogenous ketone supplementation. Mm-hmm. Can you share your thoughts on what that actually does, like what happens when you actually ingest them, and how that actually impacts, like you said, your internal state from like an enzymatic level, and how that could potentially like affect, you know, oxidation rates and preference and things like that.
Okay. So the preface to the discussion of ketone supplementation is that something to the order of 4 out of 5 studies now, potentially 5 out of 6 studies now, show that exogenous or supplemental ketones either do nothing or impair performance. This hasn't been tested across the continuum of strength and endurance sports, though. It's only really been tested in the endurance realm. So the main issue with exogenous ketones,
said it's only been tested in the endurance realm?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So the theory would be to provide your body with an alternate fuel source, so your body does not tap into, or doesn't have to tap into, its intramuscular glycogen stores. And so when you spare glycogen, in theory, you've got more mileage out of the work output you can have within a given event. So ketones are supposed to be taking care of that substrate utilization that normally would be shifted towards glycogen use. So that sounds great on paper, but the problem is when they put it to the test, even though ketones provide about 5 calories, maybe like 4.9-ish, I believe was the figure, very similar calories per gram to carbohydrate. They just simply do not perform to provide the same kind of work output that you can get out of just carbohydrate. And there is one study that's done with ketone esters that showed an advantage of ketones plus carbohydrate versus carbohydrate alone. However, the important detail with that study is that they administered a gargantuan amount of carbohydrate versus an ideal amount of carbohydrate plus the ketones. So there could have been some more severe gastrointestinal absorption issues with the huge amount of carbohydrate. I believe it was like 120, 130 grams of carbohydrate per hour of exercise versus a more ideal amount of carbohydrate, like 80-ish grams and the rest from the exogenous ketones. And that happened to outperform the huge amount of carbohydrate. So there's some design limitations and some issues with the one or two studies showing effectiveness of exogenous ketones on performance. And then the rest, you've got a mix of nothing to actual performance decreases. One of the issues with exogenous ketones is that they have a lot of problems making them bearable from a taste standpoint. And if you're sucking down something that tastes nasty enough, then it affects you psychogenically, and then this will affect you physiologically. So that whole chain of adverse handoffs would manifest as decreased performance. So I'm just not sold at all on ketone supplements for increasing exercise performance. The evidence just is not there. In fact, the bulk of the evidence would suggest against using it.
Is there any sort of incidence of like GI distress or anything like that that happens? I have no idea, so I'm just kind of asking off the top of my head.
Off the top of my head, I'm not remembering. I looked at this research like a little bit ago, and I don't think that GI distress was the main issue of why they didn't work. I think it was an issue in at least a couple of the studies, but I don't think it was an across the board thing.
Okay. Yeah.
I want to add a little note on exogenous ketones. There's a market to try to use them for all kinds of stuff. So people prescribe them for just feeling better or feeling more alert or suppressing appetite and various things of that nature. There's some clinical use for them in subjects with neurodegenerative diseases. So cognitive decline, there is some potential for their use in that department. So they're not completely write-offable, but for athletic applications, I'm pretty close to writing them off.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the times people kind of mix, or they like to blend some of the benefits of things. Like I'll hear, ketogenic is great because it, you know, improves cognition and focus and memory and 1RM strength, you know, and they just kind of like to kind of sort of blend a lot of these things in. And it's like sort of, but like under different contexts. And like you were saying, you know, if someone has some potentially like neurodegenerative disorder, then it can be beneficial in some cases and things like that. And so I often think that people tend to extrapolate the benefits beyond what it normally is, kind of like vitamins, like mega dosing vitamins, you know. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, you know, we've seen vitamin C is really important for, you know, all of these functions. And so if I take more, all of those will be bolstered, you know, or like boost your immune system through these techniques. And it's like, you don't really want to boost your immune system or else you're just going to feel like crap all the time. And yeah, so that's I've seen a lot of stuff. So I've had a lot of people approach me on Instagram and different things with exogenous ketone supplements and to try and promote it. And they've kind of tried to hand me off stuff. And I've just kind of been like, I don't really, not really about that. I'm not ketogenic. I haven't tried it. So I can't say a lot of the stuff that I hear is either just from the research or from, you know, people that I've worked with or people that I know who've done it. So
and there's a back, placebo effect too.
For sure.
If somebody tells you to keep a rabbit's foot in your pocket during your lifts, because that rabbit's foot affects the quantum energy of your synapses, and then you can
actually
fire at a higher
that
rate.
That does work. It actually does. Yeah, it does affect the quantum energy.
So if you're convinced of that, if you believe that, then it will have a positive effect. It'll have a placebo effect. So a lot of times when people are recommended a supplement that's not proven in the literature, but you know, they don't know that. And if they're marketed well enough by the person recommending the supplement, then it will actually work on a placebo basis. And there are other factors too surrounding recommendations for doing things like one thing that comes to mind, and I don't want you to forget what you're gonna ask me something, so keep it in mind. Don't lose it.
I'll remember it. You keep going.
the bulletproof coffee thing, which was just like thing. It was a thing for quite a while, not too long ago. People were saying, yeah, you know, you just. You put the butter in your coffee, you put the MCTs in your coffee, and it just makes you more alert and you just feel so, you know, so sharp mentally and all this stuff. It's hard to separate the ketosis from the fact that you're ingesting 100 or 200 milligrams of caffeine in your coffee, in your 1 or 2 cups of coffee. So the caffeine undoubtedly is going to make you more alert. Undoubtedly is going to sharpen your cognition and all of that stuff. So it's not necessarily the thing that's working that you think is working. So just wanted to add that. So yeah, go ahead. You're about to ask me something.
From like a, just purely even like a health standpoint, I know a lot of people who are doing ketosis have additional supplementation that they do to kind of bolster health and just making sure that they're kind of covering their bases because it is a very restrictive diet. What kind of supplements would you be taking or would you expect to take if you are on ketosis, if any? Or sorry, if you're on a ketogenic diet, if any.
Yeah. It depends on the degree of restrictiveness of your ketogenic diet. So generally speaking, you know, if you're consuming a broad enough spectrum of the food groups and a wide enough diversity of foods within the groups, but you still keep your diet ketogenic, then you generally don't have to worry about supplementing the diet to make sure your ketogenic diet isn't causing any deficiencies. However, if you take things to an extreme, like some people will just say, I'm going to eat cow. My diet is cow muscle. That's it. I'm so carnivore, all I eat is cow thighs. That's it. Then you have to worry about a lot of supplementation. So it kind of depends on what part of the spectrum you're on with ketogenic diets. But it's sort of right in the middle. When people go on keto, sometimes they find that they're excreting too much sodium. At times their potassium status can drop. It hasn't been a consistent thing seen in the literature, but usually it's generally an electrolyte issue that you can incur, whose manifestation at the worrisome range would be drops in blood pressure. So when people go on ketogenic diets, the general recommendation is to not be skimpy with your salt intake. And then you generally should be fine. Don't be skimpy with your intake of the range of vegetables and fruits within your ketogenic diet limit. Usually most people can fit 1 to 3 servings of fruit, depending on the type of fruit and the size of the, you know, the portion. They usually can fit that within a ketogenic diet context, along with a bunch of non-starchy vegetables, and they'll typically be fine. But from observation, as well as some iffy data in the literature, you probably don't want to skimp and restrict salt while you're on keto.
And so why is that the case?
There just happens to be, in some people, an accelerated sodium excretion through the urine when you are in ketosis. Mm-hmm. And this can be a transient phenomenon, but if it keeps going, then there's blood pressure issues to be had. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it could be the contribution of reduced glycogen stores could be that, but there are other theoretical mechanisms that probably don't have great support either. Mm-hmm. But it is an observation that's worth making and worth cautioning people about.
Right. So one of the things, like, I don't think I've ever written anyone a meal plan. And to be honest, I don't know any nutrition coach who actually does, you know? I think most of nutrition coaching, and maybe this is a bit too much of an assumption on my end, mm-hmm. kind of is a little bit more like education-based. It's a little bit more organic and kind of auto-regulatory in nature. And that's generally how I approach nutrition with a lot of my athletes. And I found that one of the big things that I usually end up working on is just adherence, right? Like mm-hmm. rate of recidivism for dieting, I think last time I checked was like 85% or something along those lines, right? Which is quite high. And I would think that that's much, much lower within like the athletic and competitive population. But yeah. Even still, it's definitely still an issue that you need to kind of keep your finger on the pulse about. So when I'm looking at the ketogenic diet, I have seen some sort of stats suggesting that it does have a little bit of a higher rate of recidivism than some of the other diets. I have seen things where, I mean, just even from the face of the diet, right, it tends to be a little bit more restrictive in nature. And then when you look at sort of like things like dichotomous thinking or, you know, like flexible restraint versus rigid restraint, things like that, these kind of indirect factors sort of come together to make a diet a little bit less successful. Now I'm type A, so I find the more rigid restraint I have, oftentimes the better I do, but I think that's pretty rare. And I think most people do better when you have a measure of flexibility, when it's a little bit more organic in terms of how the diet kind of comes together. So yeah. I guess one of the things that I struggle with is some of the upsides, not necessarily like some of the costs aren't necessarily outweighed by the opportunity in some cases from like a, just purely from like a practical standpoint. This is my observation. I know there's tons of people who've had tons of benefits from doing keto. They've lost a bunch of weight, they improved their health. And so I don't want to seem like I'm shitting on keto because I think, you know, there's a place for everything. But I think as a general recommendation of like a dietary approach, I'm really hesitant to recommend it, especially for an athlete where best case scenario, you're going to match, you know, you're going to match performance outcomes with, you know, more traditional higher carbohydrate diet. And at worst, you're going to see decrements in performance and a much higher rate of, or much higher level of, I guess, like obsessiveness and like, I don't know the word, but I'm sure you kind of get my point. so how do you, like, have you ever coached anyone who wanted to be on like a ketogenic diet or, and how yeah. do you kind of approach that
yeah,
more extreme
yeah.
mentality to make sure they kind of see that success that they're looking for?
I have ran ketogenic diets a lot in the general population. Mm-hmm. And I'll get to the athletic population in a second, but with the ketogenic diet in the general population, and this is in the minority of the general population. These are in people who actually preferred a low carb diet, and there is some pretty worthwhile experimenting to do with satiety levels and ketogenic dieting. Because with some folks who have, I don't want to say that they're lacking self-control, but people who have problems with too much variety in the diet, and they need to go for an aggressive intervention where you're reducing the palatability of the diet, you're reducing the variety, and you're simplifying the assignment. So there's minimal calculations going on. There's minimal intellectual fatigue that's going on with the dieter. They just know that they need to cut these foods out. There is some merit to that on a short-term basis for some people. But it almost harkens like the induction phase of the classic Atkins diet model that starts off really strict ketogenic, like 20 or 30 grams tops of carbohydrate. You maintain that for a shortish period of time, and then you kind of ramp up gradually over time. You know, that's not the worst idea for some people who are overweight or obese, and they need an aggressive intervention that will default them initially to eliminate a lot of these junk foods and desserts and problem foods that cause them to overeat and binge and just passively overconsume calories. And they get the quick weight loss on the outset, which in some populations who start off obese is a lot more motivating and a lot more conducive to them sticking to the plan, rather than just taking a gradual and sensible and performance optimal approach from the start. So with the general population, I'm not opposed to going kind of drastic and aggressive with calorie cuts, and the most sensible macronutrient to cut calories from would be carbohydrate at the outset. So, but that's not with everybody. These are people who prefer low carb and want to do that kind of thing and have a good reason to be that restrictive. Like they may have a tight time frame for a high school reunion or you know, heaven forbid, a pool party or something like that. There's reasons to go aggressive. But shifting over to the athletic population, unless you're cutting weight for a short period of time and you're cutting calories drastically, and you would not be attacking protein, you would attack carbohydrate and fat. And unless you have really extenuating type of reasons to do keto, the cost almost always outweighs the benefit, almost always, in a competitive athletic scenario. It's just the way that the body is able to sequester energy, fuel. If there's any element that is high intensity output, if there's intermittent high intensity output, like there is in mixed sports, you are really compromising your ability to develop athletic ability by going keto. And you brought up a really great point. It's not always about competition. It's about the training blocks. It's about the higher volume training blocks where you're developing skills and or strength. You just simply won't have the fuel available to maximize that necessary training volume if you don't have the fuel reserves to make it happen. So it is a bit of a maze. I see keto as being a much better option for general population and non-competitive populations, rather than competitive athletic populations, mainly because of the weight of the data, And even though carbohydrates would be a lot more indispensable in endurance oriented sports, you're still taking a risk if as a strength athlete or as a powerlifting athlete on the furthest end of the strength power continuum there, you're still taking a risk if you engage in it.
I tend to put a decent amount of weight in anecdote, you know, like, I guess I'll kind of clarify that. Like if you look at isometrics, for instance, right? Like isometrics, the data show quite a bit of benefit for isometrics for strength, right? For improving strength, especially like specific range of motions and, you know, the carryover is 15 degrees or some nonsense like that, right? And so on paper, there seems to be a lot of benefit to that. But then in practice, like I don't know a single high-level athlete that does them, you know? And that's not to say that they don't work. Maybe we're all just behind. But I think that there is something to be said when you look at all of the top lifters and you're like, okay, they're all doing this. They say all this stuff is really important. I don't know. I believe them, you know? And it's also like, I don't know any super elite lifters or weightlifters that are, that have adopted a ketogenic diet or even a low carbohydrate diet, you know? Again, that's not to say that you can't necessarily do it, but I think that when you see such an overwhelming amount of just evidence, like anecdotally, I think it does at least lend some credibility to the idea that, hey, there must be something here. You know, I don't think you can draw wild conclusions from that, but I do think that it is worth just noting and being like, hey, you know what, there's probably something to this if every good lifter is doing this or the vast majority of them are anyways. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of hesitant sometimes as well to do that, but I do like how you made the distinction between just gen pop and athletic populations because, you know, like I said, I have had people who have been on ketogenic diets. And I'm just like, you know what, if you can do it and you like it, then why not? Right. But if you're a competitor, I'll kind of share the pros and cons and be like, hey, there aren't really solutions. There's always going to be a trade-off or something. And so if you're doing this and your adherence is better, we get a better body composition, you know, you find it less stressful. Those are great. You might suffer in your performance a little bit, but if this outweighs it, then, you know, at least if you're aware of it, you can make an informed decision. But I guess kind of coming back to one thing you said earlier about just higher rates of electrolyte excretions or salt excretion, things like that. How would that impact weight cuts? So if a powerlifter wants to cut weight, and I know some of them do huge weight cuts. I'm not a huge fan of huge weight cuts, so I don't really recommend them, but I know a lot of people do them. Mm-hmm. How would a ketogenic diet impact that, especially since you do have that higher rate of excretion just naturally? Would there be any potential concerns for that?
Yeah, in theory, if you were using a ketogenic diet to drop weight, which is what a lot of people do, and for, you know, and it is effective because you reduce the glycogen stores in the body. And for every gram of glycogen you store in the muscle and in the liver, there's somewhere between 3 to 4 grams of water attached to it. So, some people can drop significant amounts of weight in a short period of time just by cutting carbohydrate. But, you know, when it's time to refuel, rehydrate, you better pay attention to just some of the potential electrolyte losses. So that can happen in the rehydration process. Mm-hmm. So drastic weight cuts, I stay away from that area as well. I just, you know, I let my MMA buddy coaches dabble in that if they're going to do that. But with
so
me, I just, I step back. I'm like, look, I've seen people just like carry folks out in a stretcher after the weigh-in. It's like, geez, mm-hmm. I'd rather not get into that, you know?
Right. No, that makes sense. And
I wanted to mention something that you brought up with anecdotes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's rare or almost never that you see high level athletes ketoing it. And that's absolutely true. It's almost like the higher the level athlete, the less people you're going to find messing around with trying to stay keto. And the proof is in the pudding. Jim Rohn, who's a little known like success slash business coach, one of my favorite quotes from him is, success leaves clues. So that applies to the athletic world as well. So if you look at what the guys at the top of the top tier are doing, then that's definitely going to leave you some clues about what the best way to do things might be. In the literature with protein intake, for example, we rarely see a benefit beyond like 1.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. But when you look at the habits of, we'll look at the bodybuilding world of bodybuilders who place in the top five, and this is not even at the non-tested show, at natty shows, then they average a little over 3 grams per kilogram of body weight with protein intake. Mm-hmm. So are we going to look at the literature and just cut our protein intake off at 1.8 or 2.2, you know, if you really want to push the upper end of the confidence interval? Or are we going to look at the guys placing in the top five consuming 3.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight and go, you know, I might try that because maybe it helps with satiety. Maybe it helps stave off muscle loss a little bit better. Maybe it does both of those things, but those are what the top guys are doing, and it's worth paying attention to in spite of evidence in the literature. So yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that point that you made and give an example with the bro world.
It's interesting too, because a lot of times it's very like the information you choose to believe, I guess, is self-selecting mm-hmm. a lot of times. Mm-hmm. When I was fighting, there was about a year and a half or something like that where I was like full vegan. And
how many years ago?
Oh gosh, this is a long, long time ago. This would have been like maybe 2011, 2010, something like that. Mm-hmm. Long, long time ago. And this was when I was fighting, and so like it was just all carbs, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I felt like crap all the time, but I was a high level Muay Thai fighter and boxer, you know, and like I was like, well, I'm fine and I can do this. And then I think sometimes people will look at that and they'll be like, oh, well, I can't remember that weightlifter's name, but he's a very successful weightlifter, Olympic weightlifter in the US, and he's vegan. And a lot of the times people look at that and they'll be like, oh, well, he did it, you know? And it's like, okay, sure. But he's also a genetic freak. He's a huge outlier. And, you know, I think for anecdote to be a little bit more reliable, there needs to be kind of a large body of like, okay, this is a trend, not just kind of an anomaly. And yeah, I think sometimes like, you know, you sort of self-select the information you choose to listen to. Where it's like, oh, well, you know, my friend is ketogenic and he's jacked and he's massive. And it's like, sometimes it's difficult to say, like, is he jacked in spite of or because of, you know, whatever implementation he's using. And I think parsing out some of those details can be a little bit more difficult, especially when you're looking at a lot of like indirect factors, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's like you were saying, well, maybe the guy's diet was crap before, and they just love the ketogenic diet. It allows them to, you know, keep things simple, be really restrictive. You don't have to think about it or waste any like mental energy. And their diet improved dramatically. But it's like, well, they probably have the same improvements if they did vegan or paleo or anything. It's just that their diet is improving because they're drawing a lot of attention to it. And that has a lot of indirect factors there that you can't necessarily measure or aren't necessarily, I guess, clear at first sight. Mm-hmm. So I guess that kind of brings another kind of component to it.
Those outliers like Zach Bitter in the ultra running world.
I have no idea.
people mistake him for being keto, but he's far from keto, but he's pointed to as, you know, the reason for why everybody should go on low carb. But fact of the matter is 90% of the top 10 in the history of distance running are high carb, low fat. So
yeah.
So the proof is in the pudding there, you know?
No, totally. So I know this isn't 100% relevant to maybe the audience, but I still find it interesting. So we're going to go into it.
Before we go into it, Daniel, can I put you on the spot and ask you what made you switch out of veganism?
I just felt like shit all the time, to be honest. And that's on me. Like
That'll do it.
I was, so I used to fight at 165. Mm-hmm. And to put that in perspective, right now, I'm the lightest I've been in like 4 years, and I'm 260, right?
I was going to say 250.
Yeah, yeah, pretty close. So not too long ago, about 6 months ago, I was about 295, and I was training and started cutting down weight because eventually I want to be about 370, 360, something like that is going to be my final weight. But to get there, I want to be as lean as possible. I know that I'm going to be fat at that weight. That's fine. But I want to be as lean as possible and do the most I can do to be healthy. But at that point, anyways, I was just super, super skinny. And I mean, it was great, right? Like I was a Muay Thai fighter, and good fighters, like they're really lanky, they're skinny as hell, but you know, when they hit you, you know it. I didn't really think much of it. I was studying nutrition at
do you watch MMA? Do you watch the UFC?
Yeah, I got back in and watched, like once I stopped fighting, I had a hard time watching fighting because it was just too personal for me. But I do love MMA. I do love Muay Thai. I do love boxing.
Cool.
So I watch a lot of it when I can. Awesome. Yeah.
Good.
But yeah, I was studying nutrition actually through CSNN, so Canadian School of Natural Nutrition. I had a diploma in nutrition, and they were huge proponents of vegetarian veganism. And looking back at my textbooks, I remember like reading through them maybe like a year ago and just being like, cringing. Wow, this is so much like bias just everywhere. Yeah. But that's actually why I tried it, was because I was like, oh, well, maybe this is healthier for you. And so I tried it and I gave it my best shot. And it was funny because I was sick the whole time. I was like getting infections, like because I was training so much and you're sweating so much and my immune system was just low. And so I'd get like ringworm or something like that. Or I'd like, you know, I would have a really hard time recovering from training.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like just lying to myself and be like, no, I feel great. I'm amazing. This is amazing. And it was just like, I was completely like just self-deluded.
As you talk, I'm trying to punch up a paper that I found on this. So go ahead, keep talking.
And it's funny because a lot of the times I think when we really believe something, we really want it to be true. And so we kind of try and justify or rationalize why we feel the way we do. It's like, oh, you know, you just didn't do keto right, or you didn't do veganism right, or you didn't do this. And I mean, in my case, I did a pretty decent job. I think I could obviously have done better. But I think you can kind of say that with anyone. Like I was really on it for the most part. Like I was making sure that I was getting lots of veggies. I was making sure that I was getting my proteins, my, you know, a variety of different sources and my combinations, stuff like that. So I was doing a decent job, after the first little bit anyways. I just, for whatever reason, didn't really stick, didn't really like it. And so I stopped and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to start eating how I feel. And for me, like, again, I'm European, lots of meat, lots of bread. I'm not a huge fan of fats. I don't really like a lot of fats unless they come in carbohydrates. And so, yeah, that's just what I feel best on. And I feel great.
You know, it's interesting, Daniel. That is such a common reason for people to dip out of veganism, is they just feel like shit.
Yeah.
It's like, I've heard that so many times. Mm-hmm. I've never tried veganism myself. I don't have the intestinal fortitude to try it out. But interesting, your account is very similar to a lot of people's. I punched up a paper that may explain some of that stuff. In my research review, I actually critiqued a systematic review looking at the effects of veganism on mental health. Mm-hmm. So the systematic review found that the bulk of the evidence showed adverse effects on mental health as a result of veganism. So the authors admitted that they can't draw a cause and effect relationship because we're looking at observational data. Mm-hmm. And you know, veganism is not necessarily the causal factor, but it certainly was associated with adverse mental health outcomes in the vast majority of the studies. So I don't know, there's something to think about with that. And as far as nutrients go, other than kind of the known common nutrient shortfalls in vegan diets, like B12, iron, zinc, selenium in some cases, calcium. Aside from those guys, there's other nutrients that you can miss out on, some overlooked stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's this cool paper, man, that was published just this last February. The author's last name is Wu, W-U, W-U.
Oh, yeah.
And the title is Important Roles of Dietary Taurine, Creatine, Carnosine, and Serine, and 4-hydroxyproline in Human Nutrition and Health. So it's a really, really, really well-done paper. And I would encourage anybody to give that a read if you want to fall asleep really fast. But it's it's a good paper, man. And, yeah. And there's overlooked pitfalls of veganism that begin to reveal the inconvenient reality that we humans are omnivores in terms of optimizing health. Mm-hmm. And in theory, we can concoct the most optimal range of supplements to just feed the diet, supplement the diet, and make up for these shortcomings of veganism. But we don't always do that. We can't always do that. And it manifests itself in, well, feeling like shit. So just thanks for offering your account of what you experienced.
I'm not a huge fan of, like, I guess you'd call them maybe traditional diets in general. Like, obviously I'm a fan of dieting, like, you know, restricting calories and doing different things like that to augment body composition or performance or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I think it becomes a little bit problematic sometimes when you start adhering to like a specific diet or like a trendy diet. You know, just because it ends up being super, super restrictive. And like, it's funny because a moment ago I mentioned I'm the kind of individual who's very type A, who it's like, once I'm dieting, I'm dieting. And like, I won't go out with friends. I'll do stuff like that. But it doesn't affect my quality of life. You know, like, I find if I don't do that and I'm a little loose with it, that actually gets me like a little bit more anxious and things like that. And I think a lot of the times when you're dieting, the more cumbersome something is and the more obstacles it presents to get an equal outcome compared to something else, like compared to another dietary approach, that's when I start being like, okay, you know what? I fail to see how this is beneficial if there's an easier route that doesn't necessarily cause as much stress or anxiety or, you know, preemptive planning. And if it ends up just being a little bit more cumbersome from like a lifestyle perspective, that's where I have a little bit of a hard time recommending different diets. And, you know, I think like my estimation would be that that's probably where a lot of the anxiety and stuff like that comes from, that you were mentioning from mental health, probably also nutrient deficiencies and things like that, because that definitely, you know, is going to play into it. But I'd imagine that also weighs like a significant amount. But coming back to the initial question, we're kind of got off on this a little bit tangent. I wanted to kind of get your feedback on like endurance. Aerobic or anaerobic performance is limited a lot of the times by oxygen utilization. And you're going to get a lot more ATP per molecule from like oxidizing carbohydrates versus fat. So how does that actually limit performance from like an endurance standpoint? Let's say someone wanted to be like a hybrid athlete. You know, how would that kind of impact that?
Yeah, the main way it impacts it, and this is a point that is probably made most famous by Professor Jose Arreta. He brought forth the concept of race winning moves. Race winning moves would be hill climbing, accelerating, sprinting, cutting direction. Mm-hmm. Those moves require somewhere between 80 to 120% of aerobic capacity, max aerobic capacity. And it's in that range that carbohydrate is heavily drawn upon. So with a lack of carbohydrate available, then you have a lack of capacity to successfully execute race-winning moves. Mm-hmm. Maybe one of the most classic race-winning moves in endurance sport is the final stretch sprint. Mm-hmm. So a lot of races, it's a make or break, that last portion of the race. And those who have that availability to execute that sprint are typically those who have not depleted their carbohydrate availability to critical degrees. Mm-hmm. So that's really where carbohydrate counts, is in the race-winning moves that require high-intensity output. And that would apply with intermittent high-intensity sports, mixed sports, as well as some of the more pure endurance sports as well. Mm-hmm. And another concept that Louise Burke discovered and was able to replicate recently was even in lower intensity, moderate intensity type sports, like race walking, ketogenic dieting has failed.
I think I read that paper not too long ago.
Yeah. There was one in 2017.
Yeah.
And they were able to replicate that study again just this past year, but they also added
the one that I read. Yeah.
Yeah. They added an extra group that had a periodized carbohydrate intake. So they compared the ketogenic group with the periodized carbohydrate intake with a linear high carb intake. And the periodized carbohydrate intake was low on some days, higher on other days. And the linear high was around the same total amount of carbohydrate by the end of the week. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit higher. But the linear high carbohydrate outperformed the periodized carbohydrate intake. And then the ketogenic intake, which was your classic 50-ish grams or less per day, they actually experienced a performance decrease. And this was in the event of race walking competition. So it's not just high intensity output that gets compromised by ketogenic diets. It's also exercise economy, or the amount of oxygen required for a given rate of work. That gets compromised as well. So that was kind of an eye opener to know that ketogenic dieting not only impairs the high intensity stuff, but also the moderate and lowish intensity stuff. And in race walking, for example. So it's an inconvenient research finding for a lot of people who have an emotional attachment with keto. There's been a lot of lore and romanticism and hype around keto, as if it's some sort of special or desirable state to be in. And it is kind of a special and desirable state to be in for some people who want to cut calories. For whatever reason, you want to lose weight, general population, go keto, great. Just know that you might not stick to it after 3 months. You might get sick of it after somewhere right. Between 2 to 3 months is the most common point where people really start dropping the ball with keto. It's typically the 3 month point where people find themselves creeping up towards 100 grams of carbs, where at the start of their keto, they're really gunning for that 50 grams or less. So, yeah, a little bit of a rant there.
Yeah, and that's really interesting too, because I remember that was the big thing. It was like, oh, well, it might not necessarily be the best for strength, but it's going to be better for endurance training. Like, I would hear that all the time. There's an abundance of evidence. Just do your research. And I kept hearing people saying that. And I was
just
like,
do your research.
I'm like, can you share this with me? Because I haven't seen any of this. Like, you know, I've seen some stuff out of Volek's lab and, you know, stuff like that was a little bit more like preliminary, but then it didn't really seem all that convincing. And then, the paper, I think it was called like Elite Race, something Elite Race Walkers. I can't remember, but yeah. Yep.
That's in the title. That's Burke and colleague. Burke et al. Yeah. Louise Burke. Yeah. The legendary Louise Burke.
I think I made a post about that one specifically because I thought that was kind of interesting. But it was funny how it kind of all turned around. So
yeah,
that's kind of interesting, I guess, from even from like a strongman perspective, because in strongman, like those guys are really, really well conditioned. They're not just doing a single rep. A lot of the times it's like you're doing seven stones in a really short period of time. You're pulling a truck. So you have to have this kind of sustained high intensity output.
Yeah, you would crap out real bad. You wouldn't survive. Even the studies that show that people can survive on keto with CrossFit, I dare you to gather up all the CrossFit champs in one room and have them raise their hand. All you raise your hand. Which one of you guys ketoed your way to the championships and threw it? You'll get zip zero.
Yeah, that'd be pretty shocking.
Yeah. No, it just... it won't work for that. It won't work at the highest level. And in the research that shows that people have been able to do just as well on keto as non-keto competitors and whatever the event was, whether it was more strength oriented or endurance oriented or somewhere in between, it was the weight loss that augmented the performance. So anytime you improve your power to weight ratio, you're going to perform better. But not everybody can benefit from weight loss. Not everybody is wanting to lose weight. Some people just want to get faster and keep their weight. Mm-hmm. And keto sure as hell ain't going to do that.
Yeah, and that's one of those kind of interesting confounding variables too. That's not necessarily, like you actually have to go in and read it to be able to kind of tease out some of those details. Because like if you don't have a background, if you're not really familiar with reading some of the papers, like you wouldn't know that. You'd read the conclusion, maybe the discussion area, the abstract, whatever it is that you're reading. And if you aren't like, well, for instance, like you said, if you weren't familiar with power output, you know, relative to body weight, you wouldn't even know to look for that.
Yeah.
But then if you do know that, then it's like, oh yeah, well, of course he's faster. He's carrying, you know, 20 less pounds or whatever it might be, you know, like I was terrible at pull-ups. I lost 35 pounds. And now I'm great at doing pull-ups, and it's like, what a surprise, you know? So, yeah, but those things aren't necessarily, I guess, apparent at first sight, unless you really like, and that's why, like, I think it's really been beneficial for me, even just, you know, listening to a lot of other people and kind of when they go over and do the research reviews and they're like, hey, this is kind of some things to consider. And I'm like, shit, I never even thought about that. That's a super interesting point. And it's not even necessarily about the subject of the paper. You're just like, that's a really interesting tangent. And I can't wait to go down that rabbit hole.
And sometimes with research, Daniel, researchers have their biases. You know, some of them even almost have their brand that they feel hesitant to violate or betray their previous body of work. Some researchers really pride themselves on finding benefits with ketogenic dieting, and it is a bias. And there was even an editorial done not too long ago on how researchers should not only disclose their financial biases within the manuscript, but also disclose your ideological biases. So if you're a keto ideologue, you should state that in the manuscript so people know what they're in for. Yeah. If you're a vegan or if you're a vegan activist, heck, there's keto activists, vegan activists too, you should state that in the manuscript so people are aware of kind of where the ideological framework you're working from. I'm happy to say that I'm not wedded to any particular paradigm, whether it's keto or not or vegan or not. But I think that researchers who do have that brand and that bias, I think people need to be aware of that when they read the research on this stuff. Volek and Finney did a study called the FASTER study. They did it on like ultra runners, I believe it was. It was on like elite endurance athletes. It was a study that showed some pretty extraordinary stuff in terms of substrate utilization and in terms of a lack of difference in glycogen storage after 6 months between ketogenic athletes and conventional high carb, low fat. But the one thing that they didn't report was performance differences. So yes, substrate utilization differences are interesting. Cool, that's interesting. Lack of difference in glycogen stores. Wow, that's freaking interesting. But what really matters is what happened to performance? And for some funny reason, they didn't report that. So I think people need to be aware of the potential biases of the researchers as well. I'm not going to make any hard accusations, but I've debated the great Jeff Volek in, I believe it was 2014, maybe.
Yeah, I saw that.
At the NSCA conference. And of course, I'm happy to say I feel like I handily beat him in the debate because I just brought more evidence, better evidence. But he admitted, he conceded to a lot of the comparisons of ketogenic diets with non-ketogenic diets, having an advantage in the ketogenic diet towards defaulting to a higher protein intake, especially when it's assigned on an ad libitum or unrestricted basis. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are little things to look out for like that. So unless you have your nose in the research, you won't catch those things. So that's good that you got your nose in the research.
Yeah, well, I don't really have anything better to do, so I tend to read quite a bit. So
good man.
It's either be popular or be smart. I don't know. So we're coming up on that hour mark here, and I want to be respectful of your time. So I do have one question. What's one thing, either nutrition or training, whichever you like, that isn't necessarily really well substantiated in the literature, or maybe the mechanisms, you know, not entirely clear or understood, but it's something that you feel confident personally enough to say, you know what, even though we don't necessarily know this for sure, I feel confident enough saying this is true.
But the training thing for me, let's start with the nutrition thing first. Diet and longevity is kind of a hot topic, and it's a very controversial topic because it's difficult, if not impossible, to study definitively. You can't just design studies on humans that you drag out for 10 to 50 years and see which diet works better for longevity, while accounting for all the confounding variables that might influence the outcomes. So we're never going to know what's the best diet for longevity. Mm-hmm. So my hypothesis is that the more you enjoy your diet, the more you don't dread your diet, I think that would have independent benefit on quality of life and thus longevity. Given that all the other factors are in place, right? All the other non-dietary lifestyle factors are in place, good body composition in place, non-dietary stress levels in check. I think that those who are enjoying their foods and their beverages are just going to live longer inherently because they enjoy their diet versus somebody who's fighting their way through a diet that they don't like their whole lives. Okay, so that's one, that's the hypothesis I've got on the nutritional side. As far as the training stuff goes, this is hard to substantiate as well. There's a lot of emphasis on training and longevity being biased towards endurance type work. It kind of bothers me when people make the claim that you have to, in quotes, do cardio in order to be heart healthy. And there, I really can't stand the claim when people warn against just resistance training because of left ventricular hypertrophy. if you look at the longest living people on the planet, the longest living populations, none of them actually do dedicated endurance cardio work. They're just either gardening or they're freaking doing moonlit strolls regularly. They're doing housework. they're foraging, they're farming, they're building, they're cooking, they're cleaning. That's a cardio. And they live till like 90 plus, 100 plus. So I don't buy the almost blindly accepted dictum that you got to train that to bring up that VO2 max. You gotta train your cardiorespiratory faculties and become fit. Otherwise, you won't maximize your health span. At least the observational evidence, you just have to maintain a certain level of physical activity, whether it's exercise physical activity or whether it's non-exercise physical activity. And it doesn't have to be endurance oriented or remotely even challenging per se. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the exercise thing. And then the kind of the subtext of that is, I don't think that heavy resistance training is going to compromise heart health. I think that's silly. There's just the mortality data on our resistance trainees, strength trainees, just wouldn't indicate that anyway. So, yeah, there's my biases right there, bro.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, even if someone were to tell me I would live longer if I was a little less big, I'd still be like, that's fine. So I don't know.
Nice, nice. Gotta yeah. Love it.
Do you have like any advice to individuals who are either curious about trying the keto diet, but also really concerned about their performance and body composition? Anything just to kind of leave the listeners with?
Yeah, there's no inherent benefits of keto on performance. If anything, it's inherently risky. So one of the default benefits of ketogenic diets when people try them out is this kind of accidental uptick in protein intake. So instead of looking at ketosis as a goal, look at optimizing your protein intake as a goal, because optimizing protein intake can regulate body weight through the mechanism of increasing satiety levels. So it's doing that without imposing the risk of a lack of fuel, of glycogen, carbohydrate. So that's what I would say with those contemplating the ketogenic diet. Now, if you're not in athletics, you're not in competitive athletics, you can give the ketogenic diet a try, but just know that there's nothing inherently special about it within the general population, aside from a reduction in food variety that can potentially lead to a reduction in total calories. And also in the shorter term, ketogenic diets can potentially inherently increase satiety and reduce hunger levels, but that's typically a short-lived phenomenon. So I could take or leave the ketogenic diet in the general population. But with the athletic population, I would issue a pretty strong caution there as far as performance goes, regardless of where you're at on the strength endurance continuum.
Makes sense. Where can the listeners find you? Where are you most active? Are you working on any projects right now?
I am most active on Instagram. And I do a little bit on Facebook and Twitter. I recently started waking Facebook up again, or tried to wake them up again, to having some nutritional debates. But I don't know, in these days and times, the Facebook boomer crowd doesn't really want to argue over nutrition. They mainly want to argue over politics. So you can mainly find me on Instagram. My handle is TheAlanAragon. And my Twitter handle is TheAlanAragon, only because someone else took Alan Aragon. I didn't, you know, I wasn't wanting to add the V there. And that's it. You can find my research review on AlanAragon.com. And so my research review is, it's my best work. And I've included the contributions of the best in the field within the research review. They've all contributed to it. They've all grown up on it. So I'm talking to everybody from Israetel to Helms to Lyle McDonald to a lot of folks. A lot of folks who are names in the business have all been a part of the research review, and I'm just really proud of that body of work. It's a 12-year archive of monthly issues that I've received a lot of great feedback about, and I'm not afraid to say it's awesome and you should check it out.
Totally. So yeah, we're going to link all that stuff up in the show notes. So if you guys want to check that out, make sure you go give him a follow, check it out. Got a lot of really, really great content he's posting on a regular basis. And I actually, I'm almost never on Facebook anymore. I deleted the app off my phone because people just get too aggressive. And so I'm like, I'm going to stick to Instagram. You know, people don't get it's quite as mad.
Probably best for your mental health, man.
Totally. Yeah. All right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate you coming on the show. It was super interesting chatting with you about keto, about just kind of some other additional tangents that we went off on. But yeah, man, thanks a lot.
Happy to do this again at some point before you hit a lean 300 pounds, man.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. Take care.
Thank you.
Guys, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode and took a lot from it that you can apply to your own situation to see much better results. I just have one quick personal favor to ask of you. Please make sure you subscribe and leave me a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using. When you do this, it helps me get better at producing content and increases my exposure so I can continue putting out high quality information for you guys. Next, I want to extend a personal invitation to shoot me a DM on Instagram at StackedStrength. I'll help you troubleshoot anything you need. This is literally an invitation to connect with me directly, so make sure you head on over and jump into my DMs. All right, guys, thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.